Revelation chapter 16, look at verse 19. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of His wrath. We dealt with this a couple of weeks ago, sort of out of order, but the idea of great Babylon coming to remembrance before God. Notice that this is talking about the end of the tribulation. The seals are done, the trumpets are done, the vials are done. I mean, it's the last plagues are done. They're getting ready, and God is calling all the armies of the world, and He's working it all out and getting them all to come to a place called Armageddon to have that final battle that you'll read about in chapter 19. It's the culmination of history, folks. This is what it all is. And as God's getting it all together, Babylon comes to remembrance. The Bible says, got a loose end to tie up. I don't know if you've thought about it, but God can hold a grudge. God can see something happening and He says, I'm going to do something about that. And yet at the same time, He's extremely patient. And He'll put it off for I don't know how long. And sometimes we wonder, well, how does this affect? I don't understand. And God's got His own way of thinking. And the truth is, God's way of thinking is better than our way of thinking, so we're going to have to trust Him in this. But what I'm wanting to teach you here is part of a greater series on separation and how we as Christians need to make sure that we are following the Lord and whatever. But this thing about the separation from Babylon, the idea is to understand Babylon and how important it has been in our history, not only our immediate past history, but throughout all history. It meant something to the apostles. It meant something to the persecuted church. It meant something in the Middle Ages. It meant something to the reformers. It meant something to the Great Awakenings. And it meant something in the millenarian movement that has, you know, now shown up all over the world through people like us. Because we believe the Bible literally. And we're saying, this is talking about something that's going to happen. Yes. This is relevant. It's relevant to today. And so now what we have is we look at the tribulation is happening in the book of Revelation. The tribulation in the book of Revelation between chapters 4 and 19 has 13 visions talking about what's going to happen in the book of Revelation, what's going to happen in the tribulation. And this is the 11th of the 13. This is the vision of Babylon. And it takes up 2.5 chapters, a little bit of chapter 16, a little all of 17, all of 18, and a little bit of 19. And this is a big deal in God's mind. He's going to deal with Babylon. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I dealt with the identity. I believe that is an unassailable conclusion. I do not believe you can miss this if you are willing to let God speak. If you're just willing to let Him say what He wants to say, the identity of Babylon is the city of Rome. The mystery of Babylon, excuse me. I know that there are three suggestions as to what it means, even for people who believe the Bible literally and think it's going to happen. Some people have believed that it's the original city of Babylon that's going to be rebuilt. And I believe that is scripturally disproved conclusively because God gave a warning to Jeremiah and to Isaiah and to other prophets that this Babylon that it has destroyed Jerusalem was itself going to be destroyed by kingdoms of the north are going to come in, and then it was going to be disinhabited, and then it was going to be completely wiped out with no inhabitant, and it would never, ever, ever be rebuilt. That's what it says. Not just one time, but half a dozen times at least. So Babylon, the city of Babylon, existed. It was taken over. It was destroyed several times, but it was still around as late as Alexander the Great. And then when Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was divided up into four. His empire was divided up into four between his four major generals. And they fought it out. And basically, the Macedonian Empire under Alexander the Great no longer existed. It separated out. In fact, all of that is actually predicted in the book of Daniel, right down to the details. And I'm not going to get into that. But just the point is that the city of Babylon, was destroyed completely and disinhabited somewhere in the generation following Alexander the Great, so that the city did not exist. Even though that Babylon is mentioned in the New Testament. It's mentioned by Peter. Peter says there's some Christians here in Babylon that salute you or that greet you. And some people will say that that's talking about Rome, and maybe it is, but I'm not sure. What I do know is that Babylon continued to be a province of Persia long into, until the Muslim conquest in 700 AD. So when the Muslim took over it, the Persian province of Babylon ceased to be, and there was a tremendous community of Jews in the province of Babylon in Persia, but that wasn't the city. The city Babylon was destroyed hundreds of years before Christ. And the Bible says it's never going to be rebuilt. So, the identity is not the original Babylon. That's why it's called Mystery Babylon. Other people, because they don't like the conclusion, and that's not a real good reason to come up with your decision, because you don't like the conclusion of the evidence. But because they don't like the conclusion, they say it cannot be talking about Rome. It must be talking about Jerusalem. And because Jerusalem is called a great city, in chapter 11, it says the great city, Jerusalem, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt. And so they say, well, great city, and over here it says Babylon's a great city, so it's talking about Jerusalem. And they've got their reasons to believe that, their explanations. There's a Roman Catholic party that believes that, because, and they also believe that everything was fulfilled in the first century war when Jerusalem was destroyed. And that just means it's not relevant anymore. I don't agree with either one of those ideas. The other possibility is the same possibility that has been believed by every group since the beginning. And all you got to do is ask yourself, who was John the Apostle talking about when he says those things that we studied last week? Who was he talking about? What city was he talking about? The city that reigns right now, reigning over all the kings of the earth. That city that's on many cultures and many nations, whatever. That city that has seven hills, that seven mountains. It's the city of seven mountains. And everybody knows the city of seven hills is Rome. Those hills were there since forever, and they're named. They're actually named. Each one of those hills has a name. Everybody knows the city of seven hills. So when John writes the city that sits on seven mountains, the city that reigns over, this is an empire city, whatever, he's talking about Rome. Yeah. He intends to get across to us that he's talking about the city of Rome. One of the reasons people have a hard time with saying that that's Rome is because Rome just doesn't seem like a very important city right now. And it's not. It's not a very terribly important city. If it weren't for the Vatican there, then it probably wouldn't have hardly any significance whatsoever. Cities come and go. The very most important cities nowadays in 100 years are not going to be the most important cities. In fact, if you look at the cities that are now, the huge cities that are running things, most of them are in Asia. They're talking about monster cities over there that, and, you know, we don't seem to give them much mind. So why would God say that Rome is important to Him still? Well, the Bible says something's going to happen in the future with this city. It says it pretty clearly here in the book of Revelation. But God doesn't always think the way we think. He doesn't always do things the way we would expect Him to do things. Maybe God doesn't care too much about New York. Maybe God doesn't care a lot about London or Paris. But God still remembers Rome. Yes. He's got a problem with this city, Rome. All right, we got the identity. I don't believe there's any doubt. John the Apostle was obviously talking about Rome. It's clear there in the Scriptures itself. He wasn't trying to mask it. It wasn't a hidden thing. It was just... it was a poetic way of putting it out there. It was a vision that he saw. But he was not trying to hide the identity or even fool anybody. He knew that everybody was going to know what the city was when he wrote these things that he wrote. The city is Rome. Now, back in those days, they assumed it was a pagan city, a city of you know, unspeakable crimes, and warlike, and also very organized, and did a lot of good for the places they conquered. That's true. And yet, at the same time, they were looking at this city as a conquering city and what have you, but John wasn't criticizing the city for its empire, and he wasn't criticizing the city for the things that we might think about Rome being, the Colosseum and these kind of things. He was criticizing this city for its spiritual connection to Babylon. There was a spiritual connection to Babylon. And so we try to figure out, well, what's this? What is this significance? What is this spiritual connection? So I'm just going to give you an overview of how God sees the world and what is actual reality. You see, we have the tendency to think that reality is what you can see. But the Bible says there's a lot of things you can't see. And these things that you can't see are what's real. This is what's real. And Daniel talks about wars that were happening in heaven that had to do with things happening on earth. And even in the book of Ephesians chapter 6, Paul says, we wrestle not against, flesh and blood and earthly powers, whatever. But he says, there's spiritual wickedness in high places, and these are the spiritual rulers of this darkness. So there's something going on that you can't see that's bigger than all the stuff that you can see. There are wars going on in heaven. Read Revelation chapter 12 about the war in heaven, that something happens and then the earth is really going to suffer because of something that happened in heaven. And Daniel brings it out, and Jeremiah and other prophets in the Old Testament bring out this fact that there are spiritual beings that are called rulers of the darkness. They're the powers, the princes and the powers of the air. They're invisible, you can't see them, but they're making a difference right now all over the world. Something about Babylon, there was a spirit ruling in Babylon, something going on with Babylon that somehow got taken up into Rome. Now, I'm not going to try to explain this because I don't understand how this is or how this works. I haven't ever gone in the spirit, in the body, or out of the body, I cannot tell. I've never done that sort of thing. So I can't go up there and say, I saw this, or I saw that. I don't know. I'm just reading what it says. Obviously, there was a spirit of Babylon, a spiritually fornicating spirit, that John says, well, there it is. It's in Rome. Now, this is what he intended to tell you. John wanted to tell you, Christian. He wanted to tell you there's a spirit that came from Babylon that's now associated with the city of Rome. Amen. That's what he wanted to tell you. And it doesn't matter what anybody else can say, well, there's another way to see this. Yes, it's true, but that's not what John wanted you to see. It was so clear to him. It was clear to all the early fathers. While they were being persecuted, they knew what God had prophesied about this persecuting city. They knew. They knew that it was a wicked, evil city, and they knew what was prophesied. God was going to have His vengeance on this city. If it doesn't happen now, don't worry. It's going to happen. These people that were going to their deaths because they were Christians, being persecuted by these emperors, had it in the back of their head, in their mind, saying, it's okay. God's got it all under control. He's already prophesied this city's going down. And all the apostles and saints are going to rejoice when it happens. This was a big subject for those that were suffering under the persecutions of the emperors. So big, in fact, that there are still today existing letters and books that were written back in those days by Christians detailing how God makes this happen. I mentioned, I believe, a certain Lactantius who wrote a book on how the extraordinary deaths of the persecutors, these emperors that persecuted Christians, and he wrote down histories of how they died. And they didn't die nice, fun, easy deaths, or peacefully die in their bed. These were pretty extraordinary deaths, if what he says is true. And I'm not vouching for him at all. I'm just saying this was an important point to people during pagan Rome's reign, that Rome, God's got Rome in His sights. But something happened. Constantine converted. Something changed. And yet, we can see right now this is still relevant. Obviously, this spirit associated with Rome has not changed. So what's the relevance? What is God trying to tell us now about the city of Rome? Remember, this was prophesied years ago. Think about the book of Daniel and its prophecies about the book of Daniel, the prophecies. The image that Daniel saw that starts with the head of gold, which is Nebuchadnezzar, and then it has the silver, which is Medes and Persians, and that's divided into two, which corresponds to the arms. Then you have the trunk, which is some other material, and that's Alexander the Great, bronze, I guess. And then you have the iron, which is the loins downward, and iron is the strong. This is obviously the Empire of Rome. And it divides into two because of the two legs, and then it divides into ten because of the ten toes. And it changes its character because it's not just iron, it's mixed with clay. I'm telling you, if you study out these, things, the history of the world was laid out for us. Right there in a line. You don't have to be a genius to figure this out. God knew what was going on. Scholars nowadays say, well, Daniel was not written in 600 years before Jesus, because obviously if you have such minute and specific prophecies that come to pass, we know it had to have been written afterwards. And so they'll say Daniel was written, you know, in the year 150 BC, which is just stupid, because, I mean, some of the things he prophesied about happened way after that also. So the prophecies are there, and they're undeniable. They were written years and years ago, and they're still relevant today. Rome, as an empire, is still existing today, according to the Bible, in a funny form, because it says the iron is mixed with clay, and these ten kings are still to come. It says so in Revelation. So, it is relevant. What does it mean? What's the relevance? What are they trying to tell us? During history, you had people knowing that this was relevant. They knew what Babylon stood for. They knew it talked about Rome. And they had their own way of applying it. So that you had, during the Middle Ages, you have a hard time finding references to Rome in a negative way during the Middle Ages. And one of the reasons why is because there was no printing press, and printing was a lot easier to control. And the Roman Empire, what they call the Holy Roman Empire, the papacy, had a lot more control over what was printed and what remained for us to read later on. But you can see some of it clearly. For example, I'm going to read. Let me see. I know I wrote this in there somewhere. Dante, this Italian writer, wrote a book called Inferno back in the 1200s. This is the Middle Ages. This is before the Reformation. He was talking about the priests of that day. He said, "Shepherds like you, the evangelist had in mind when he saw the one sitting on many waters." That's talking about Revelation 17. Said, these priests, John the Apostle was talking about you when he wrote about Babylon the Great, the mystery Babylon, the whore that sits on many waters. So they knew, even in the Middle Ages, who this whore was. You get to the Reformers. Boy, you get to the Reformers. The Reformers knew exactly who it was talking about. It was talking about Papal Rome. And Martin Luther wrote a book called The Babylonian Captivity of the Church. He says, "I know of a certainty that the papacy is the kingdom of Babylon." It's what they believed. And this is what the great evangelists during the Great Awakenings believed. This is what every one of them believed all the way to our generation. What is God trying to tell us? What is this spirit of Babylon? Well, we went over it very, very briefly at the very end of my lesson a couple of weeks ago. Number one, the spirit of Babylon is fornication. Possibly literally, I don't know for sure, but there is a spirit of fornication in the air sometimes, and you can tell it, you can see it. But this is definitely a religious fornication, meaning idolatry, some kind of an impurity, a spiritual uncleanness. You read it in Revelation, it talks about devils and foul spirits. It talks about mother of harlots and abominations and filthiness and things of that nature. And this is talking about idolatry, obviously. You know, there's two kinds of idolatry. There are two kinds of idolatry. Did y'all know that? Anybody know what the two kinds of idolatry are? Physical and spiritual. That might be. See if we can knock it down. It says so in Romans chapter 1. Let's read it, just because I'll quote it wrong or get something backwards or something. I had never thought about it in the sense of spiritual and physical, but let's see if it is. Maybe we're saying the same thing. Romans chapter 1 mentions two kinds of idolatry. Look at verse Look at verse 23. And change the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. The first type of idolatry is where you take the glory of God and represent Him by some creature in an image. Whether it's a painting or whether it's a carved image or a sculpted image or a, you know, some other sort of thing like that or some kind of a symbol. You try to reduce the glory of God into an image. So the use of images in worship is one kind of idolatry. Read verse 25. Who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is best forever. Second kind of idolatry is serving the creature more than the Creator. That's where you focus on creatures, such as saints. There are two kinds of idolatries. And both of these kinds of idolatries are found in Babylon. And it's an amazing thing. It will open your eyes if you go to a place where idolatry is still strongly practiced. It'll wake you up. Now right here it's not near so strong. But I'm telling you, 5-6 hours south, you go into some of the deepest hearts of Roman Catholic Mexico, and you will find idolatry of the most evil, horrible nature. Something that if I go to the trouble to describe, you would have a hard time believing that this can't be. That maybe there's some people who are that confused, but I'm talking about millions of people. Millions of people who believe that little dolls do miracles. Or, you know, cry in the night or move their eyes or things like that. And they have all kinds of things. I mean, idolatry and worshiping and serving creatures instead of the one God, the type of honor given to certain saints, such as the Virgin Mary or Saint Jude of Lost Causes or things of this nature, this type of reverence. I was once invited into a house of a lady who I was trying to give the gospel to. She invited me in to prove that she didn't need to be evangelized. She said, come on in. She had set up an entire room, the largest room in her house. The entire room was set up as a devotion, a shrine to St. Jude. St. Jude of the Lost Causes. She had some images in there. And these images aren't cheap, by the way. These idols, they pay a lot of money for these things. And they are painted up, gaudy, whatever. Some of those idols were taller than me. She just had the room full of them. She says, I have been devoted to St. Jude since I was a child, and I have not failed to go to Mass every morning at 6 o'clock for 32 years. I haven't failed. This is an idolatry. It's something that's got a hold of her heart and mind that it requires a spiritual warfare to deliver her from. It's not innocent, folks. This is not small. This is a huge thing in God's eyes. It's a fornicating spirit. Another thing that fornication is spiritually is talking about, not just the idolatry, but the assimilation. The morphing of religions. It's just an acceptance of all kinds of trash. This was Babylon. Babylon just accepted it all. Babylon just sucked it all in. It assimilated everything. It's called, among the scholars, it's called syncretism. Syncretism. You can look it up and study it out. Here, I've got it on by the Catholic Encyclopedia. Syncretism is sometimes used to designate the fusion of pagan religions. In the East, the intermixture of the civilizations of different nations began at a very early period. When the East was Hellenized under Alexander the Great, and somebody in the 4th century B.C., the Grecian and Oriental civilizations were brought into contact, and a compromise to a large extent affected. The foreign deities were identified with the native. In other words, Serapis was Zeus and Dionysius, and a fusion of the cults succeeded. After the Romans had conquered the Greeks, the victors, as is known, succumbed to the culture of the vanquished. And the ancient Roman religion became completely Hellenized, that is, made into a Greek type of religion. Later, the Romans gradually received all the religions of the peoples whom they subdued, so that Rome became the temple of the whole world. Syncretism reached its culmination in the 3rd century AD under the emperors Caracalla, Heliogabalus, and Alexander Severus. Countless cults of the Roman Empire were regarded as unessential forms of the same thing, a view which doubtless strengthened the tendency towards monotheism. This certain fellow, this Heliogabalus even sought to combine Christianity and Judaism with his religion, the cult of the sun god. Julia Mamaea, the mother of Alexander Severus, attended in Alexandria the lectures of Origen, and Alexander placed in his lararium the images of Abraham and Christ. These were pagans, entirely pagans, but they had no problem with your religion. They say, that's fine, we conquer this thing, well, your gods are our gods, it's the same gods, we just try to figure out who they are. Now, this is an idolatry that exists all the way to this day. I'll tell you, it's an amazing thing how you see it happen. And if you had never seen it happen in person or done the research on your own turf where you realize what has actually happened, you might doubt that this is really what happened way in the past. But we've seen it right here in Mexico. There's a little hill in Mexico called Tepeyac. This hill, back when the Spanish conquerors were coming in here, there was a pyramid on top of this hill. This is Tepeyac. This pyramid was the place of worship of a goddess called the Mother of the Gods. Mother of the Gods, this goddess' name was Tonantzin, and this Tonantzin had a skirt of serpents, and it was a fiery, fierce goddess that all of the different Indian groups worshipped. You had different tribes coming from all over Mexico to this little hill that's now inside the city limits of Mexico City. This little hill, they would come from all over. When the Spaniards conquered them, they said, well, what we got to do is destroy this pyramid. And so they went, destroyed the pyramid and built a little chapel and said, we dedicate this chapel to the true Mother of God, not the Mother of the Gods, but the Mother of God, which is Mary. And that's what they insisted. And what happened? All the Indians kept coming to this hill every winter solstice, which at that time was the 12th of December. And the 12th of December, they would all show up at this hill and they were still worshiping Tonantzin, but now there was a little chapel there instead of. And so the Roman Catholic authorities, mainly the Franciscans, they said, look, you can't come here on December the 12th. You've got to come here to worship the Virgin on her day. Her day is September the 8th. And so they insisted. They even tried to force it. They tried to by coercion. They tried to shut it down so that they couldn't. And it didn't matter what they did. They put big gates or whatever so that they wouldn't come on December the 12th, which was the winter solstice of those days back in the early 1500s. And they said, you can't come on December the 12th. You got to come on September the 8th. But they just wouldn't do it. And they were coming as far away from Guatemala and Honduras and all the way up north. They were coming from all over the place to worship Tonantzin at this site, at this little hill called Tepeyac. And I don't know why this hill was important to them, but they would come from all over on the 12th of December. And so they finally gave in. They said, well, Tonantzin is really the Virgin Mary. And her day is the 12th of December. And to this day in Mexico, the 12th of December is the day of the Virgin of Guadalupe, even though it's now no longer even the winter solstice. Now they had to change the calendar because they had lost so many days and they had to add 10 days to the calendar or whatever. So now the winter solstice happens on the 22nd. But December the 12th, which was their day of the winter solstice, is actually the day of the Virgin Mary in Mexico, not anywhere else in the world. That's nowhere else in the world, but it is in Mexico. It's the day, the 12th of December. They still said it's a huge day in Mexico to this day. Now you say, well, when does this matter? Well, it matters because it's syncretism. It's an assimilation. It's a fornicating attitude that these people had that we're just going to accept it all and say, this is what this means. We're just going to give it our meanings. We're going to say, this is what this all is. Once you see it, you begin to react and say, how can this possibly be? How can somebody be this ignorant? What happens when they keep coming on this day? And during the time they're trying to stop them from coming on December the 12th and force them to come on September the 8th. They had a painter down there in Mexico. He painted a little image, and they began to say this image does miracles. They started off trying to say that it'll do the miracle on September the 8th and what have you. And you can read all this story. It's all been researched and verified, and it's all Catholic authorities that say this. It's not like this is a Protestant conspiracy to try to to undermine what the Catholic authorities are saying down there. No, the Catholic authorities are telling us what happened down there. And what happened was, they tried to force this thing, and this image they said started doing miracles. Well, they came up with a story. You might have heard the story as the story of Juan Diego. Juan Diego is this little Indian boy that saw the Virgin Mary on December the 12th, and that's why this is so important. That's why this date is so important here, because this little Indian boy, you know, 10, 15, 20 years old, I don't know how old he was, but he saw the Virgin, she appeared to him on this day. Even though there is absolute factual proof that this boy could not have been strolling over this hill on that day, because every single year for 1,000 years, this hill was covered with people on that day. In fact, weeks before that day, because this hill was holy long before the Spaniards conquered. Well, Juan Diego supposedly saw this virgin there, and she gave him or his mantle. She put some flowers. He gathered the flowers from this and put it in his mantle and took it to the priest there at the time. And the priest's name, he opens it up, and on this mantle, this shawl that this boy, this Juan Diego, had, when he opened it up, the flowers were there, but they had stained it, and the stain was this picture of the Virgin of Guadalupe. And that's the stain, and that's the picture that's still there. Now, this picture has been repainted, a lot of times, and so it's not at all in its original glory, whatever. In fact, we have evidence that we know who painted the picture. We know why he painted the picture. It's all written out. It's clear. But the lie has been told, and you try to tell a devoted Mexican that this is not true what they're telling you, and you are taking your life into your hands. You're taking your life into your hands. They will not put up with it. They will not accept it. That is the reason. When you stand up and say, all of this stuff is a lie, God did not command this, you're not supposed to be praying to this one. Why? Because they have adapted the pagan, Aztec, Mexica, Toltec religion, adapted it to Christianity. And now that's what it is. Christianity in Mexico is that. That's what it is. That's what they know of as Christianity. And yet I say that's not Christianity at all. That's syncretism. That's assimilation. That's the spirit of idolatry that was found in Babylon. And it moved to Rome. And it's still in Rome. And it's all over the Roman Empire to this day. In fact, you start studying where things come from, you start realizing things are not what they seem. There's an awful lot of lies going on in the world, an awful lot of junk. Now, God warned us about this spirit of syncretism in the very first century by the apostles. And make no doubt about it, God intended for you to understand the danger of this junk. He wants you to know this is not good. This is not... We're gonna get to the attitude we're supposed to have, and the attitude is mentioned several times. He says, come out from among her, my people. Be ye separate. Don't touch the unclean stuff. And that's what Christians that believe the Bible have been doing since the days of the apostles. They've noticed it. They've seen it. They've accused it as being the Babylonian influence. And they've come out and been separated. And they've been persecuted for 2,000 years now because of that. It's Christian separation, people. It's where we say, we understand. God has given us an understanding. And we're not going to be fooled by this. We're going to follow God. We're going to follow what He... Now listen, if I'm just making this up, if this is just, an excessive conspiratorialist idea, we're trying to find a Jesuit under every rock. And there's a lot of excessive conspiracy theories out there that are not really realistic. And we need to get into that and explain how you have to be cautious about this. And yet all that, let me tell you something. If this is just an imagination, if we're just putting this together so we can be overzealous about something that's not terribly necessary, then you don't have to pay attention to this. You don't have to listen to it. You just, you know, do your own thing. But if you can see it in the Bible, you can see that this is actually what he was telling you. This is actually what he was teaching you about, trying to get you to understand so that you could make a rational, clear decision about how you're going to serve Jesus, how you're going to believe the Bible and what you're going to stand for. Well, then you have some decisions to make. You're going to have to be separate in some ways. You're going to have to say, no, I'm not going down that road. I'm not going to be part of that. That is the spirit of Babylon. Mention sorceries. In chapter 18, verse 23, it talks about sorceries. Sorceries were this mystical way that certain people would lord it over the used to have the alchemists in the Middle Ages, because they could do funny things with chemicals, and they would make certain chemicals join together and they would burst into flame or something like that. And it fooled ignorant people into thinking they had some kind of spiritual power. This is sorcery. The sorcery was where they would use gimmicks to fool people. This is what we might call nowadays priestcraft. I don't know if you realize it, but you have religions where you have priests that do mysterious things. They do this and they do this. Have you ever seen a magician? You ever seen him? He'll do this. And you're looking at that hand there, and this is the hand you should be looking at. I'm serious. This is exactly what they're doing. They're making you look over here, and they're doing something with this hand. And it's just a trick. It's just a trick. And if you use a trick to make people think you have spiritual power, you're a sorcerer. You're being sorceristic. That's not a word, it is now. Priestcraft is exactly that. Let me ask you something. What's the difference between a priest and a regular person? Nothing. There's no difference. They're born the same. They're exactly the same. There's no difference. They got no powers you don't have. They're no closer to God than you are. Probably a lot farther from God than you are. Why does somebody want to be set apart as a priest and say that I have power with God that you don't have? It has to do with power. And it's not power with God, because they have no power with God. It's power over you. And if they can control your mind, if they can make you think that they are holy, they're the closest thing to God you're ever going to see. If they can make you think that, you will prostitute yourself for them. I'm not joking. This is documented. They're prostituting themselves. You don't know how many women I've talked to who gave their bodies to the priest because he was holy. I'm not joking here. You know, when I read the ex-priest Chinnicky's book, The Priest, The Woman, and the Confessional, I did not believe it. I said, there's just no way. No woman is that stupid. If there might be some woman that's that stupid, but most women are not that stupid. But after reading it, I had some Bible studies and some talking with some friends of mine in León who were not Christian. They were not Christian. They were Catholic, and they never did get saved. They never did believe what I was trying to teach them. But I had these Bible studies with them, or just talks with them, and I just asked them, when you go to confession, does the priest ask you certain things? Like what? Sexual questions. Because this is what the book said, that the priests ask sexual questions of their confessors, the people that they're listening to confession to. And they do that in order to open the door. And I said, that can't be true. And I asked them, and all of those women said, yes, they do. I said, well, why do they do that? And they said, we think it's because they want to excite us. I was just knocked over. I just could not believe it. They were telling me this is true. I have actually had women come up to me while I'm preaching and says, I want you to talk to the priest for me. Why? She had a little baby here. She was holding on by the hand, and she was pregnant. I said, well, why do you want me to talk to the priest? She says, well, because these are his children, and he's no longer going to give me any support for them. And I said, well, what can I do? Well, I figure you can talk to him and see if you can get him to keep giving me support for these kids. This is a married woman, folks. You say, how is this possible? It's possible because of sorcery, because of priestcraft. The priest dresses different. The priest does all kinds of mysterious things. The priest is all hidden. Have you ever noticed that these kind of religions that have priestcraft, everything is hidden. Nothing is out in the open. Look at the back of our building here, and you'll see a list of what the money goes to. Try to find that in the Vatican. Try to find that in the Jehovah's Witness organization. Try to find that among the Mormons. Try to find it anywhere where there is this idea that, no, it's all hidden. It's all protected. Why? Well, you know, they got their reasons. But I'll tell you why. It's to keep secret. It's to keep secrets. It's so that people can't hold them accountable. This is called priestcraft. It's the idea that I've got certain connections to God that you don't have. You need me. And so I'm going to tell you this, that, and the other thing. Now, you see, it's very unfashionable nowadays to be anti-Catholic. It's unfashionable. And I really don't consider myself anti-Catholic. It's going to be a little bit difficult to persuade you of that, but it is true. And I'll have to get into that later. There's no way I can get into it now. I can't even believe I've lost my whole hour. I haven't got even through the significance part. Anyway, priestcraft, the idea is that these priests have some kind of a power and that you need them. When they convince people of this, and they do this to little children, these little children become convinced that this priest has the power. Now, what they'll say is, this is anti-Catholicism. What this is just, it's like anti-Semitism. Well, you just hate Catholics because you hate Catholics. Because you're just a hater. You're just a hater type of a person and you just hate Catholics. And I don't hate Catholics. And I'm not anti-Catholic. I really am not. I actually think that there are some things in the Catholic Church that were of God. That's going to be difficult to explain, but it's true. It's true, and I can prove it to you. But the point here to be made is, it's not fashionable nowadays to be anti-Catholic, because nowadays we have enemies of any kind of faith. We have such atheistic type anti-Christian enemies nowadays that we kind of want to join forces. You know, we all want to get together, and so we'll fight the arch enemy of God, which is atheism. Let me tell you something. Atheism is not a problem. God can just wipe out atheism anytime He wants. Now, you just do a couple of miracles and atheists are gone. It's like they're done. There were no atheists in Jesus' day. Because Jesus was doing miracles, why are you going to be an atheist when that's happening? You just can't be. Atheism is not a problem. Atheism is an irritation when God says, let them go their way. But the truth is, when the things in the book of Revelation start happening, they're not going to be any atheists anymore. That's going to just go away. It's a dead in the water philosophy. Actually, it's dead in the water just by pure reason alone. But, you know, whatever. That's a different argument. The point is, there is a spiritual problem here. And we're not wrestling earthly minds, no matter how intelligent they think they are. It's amazing how atheists have to talk about their own intelligence. It amazes me. But no matter how intelligent and intellectual and rational and supposedly superior intellects they are than us, They aren't the issue. The issue here is we are wrestling spiritual wickedness in high places. Amen. And these wickedness, these rulers, these spirits in high places have power over immense numbers of people. Billions of people. They have direct influence over them. And that's what we're wrestling. You aren't smart enough to win this fight. You need God. You need God's Word. And you need to just trust God and do what the right thing is, because that's the only thing that can have any victory in this. You have to have God on your side in that. But I'm not trying to raise up a conspiracy theory about stuff. I am not a conspiratorialist. I do not believe conspiracies are reasonable. And the reason why is because once you get more than one or two conspiratists in it, It's not going to be secret for very long. You know, there's conspiracies all over the place, ideas of conspiracies. I've heard people say that the CIA causes this or that and the other thing. And I'm thinking, well, how could they do that? What are you talking about? Or I've heard about Jesuits. I've heard about the Illuminati or the Masons. Or, you know, they're all doing these things. They're puppets. They're pulling the strings behind it. Listen, don't listen to it. Conspiracies are really hard to pull off. They're just really hard. Most of these things are not true. There's not a Jesuit behind. I don't believe that anybody in here is a Jesuit trying to undermine us. Okay? I just don't believe that. If it's true, it's like yawn about it, and you know that's all you need to do about it. If there's nothing to worry about in that sense, but there are spiritual issues that we do have to deal with. And especially you need to understand what God wanted you to know about how you need to remain keep yourself separate and from whom you need to keep yourself separate and what you need to do to protect yourself from the spiritual malignity that's in. Real quick, another point, not just the priestcraft, but the merchandise. You read about this Babylon, one of the spirits is merchandise. It's a money-making machine. You want to get married in church? $2,000. You want to get your husband out of purgatory? $400 per mass. After 9 masses, he'll be out. Oh man, I'm not joking here. This is a real money-making machine. You know why they hate us when we preach against images? Because that's the number one fundraising thing in Mexico. You get a little image in a backwoods town in Mexico, and they run the little theory that, you know, this image does miracles. Well, people from all over come because everybody needs a miracle. They come from all over and they leave money at the image. And the priest that has this little image gathers up that money. That's how they make money. And then we go into that city and say, hey, this is all a lie. Well, what do you think they're going to do? They don't like that at all. They put us in jail. No, it's not for no reason, but it's just, it's a money-making machine. And that's what all these religions are getting caught up. All these Christian groups are getting caught up in. Money-making.
That's right.
It's a merchandising conglomerate. This is a huge merchandising machine that's going on in the name of Christ. Another of the spirit of Babylon is persecution. World domination. They did a tremendous amount of persecution. You'll see the spirit of Babylon still alive and well. Another thing that you might not really realize it is that's the spirit of motherhood. Babylon was a matriarchal religion. It was a female goddess type of religion. And so was Rome. In fact, they had the mother of God long before Mary ever came about. There was a mother of God. You read over there in Jeremiah where it talks about the queen of heaven. These were the Babylonian goddesses. Tammuz was the son of the sun that came from the virgin queen, the mother of the queen of heaven, the mother of God. This all existed before Mary. And it was gone right down through Babylon, right over through Greece, right into Rome. It's all there. And they were still doing all that kind of worship. And now we have that same thing. We have the Queen of Heaven still worshiped today in Roman Catholic areas. Still today. And if you just watch the news ever so often, they'll see a picture of her in, you know, a piece of toast or a stain on a sidewalk or something. There it is. That's her. I see her. She has appeared. And why? Because they're obsessed with the motherhood of God. She's a queen. She's not a widow. She's whatever. She's narcissistic, blasphemous, self-loving, self-promoting. It's a real self and delicacy, luxury, incredible gaudiness and luxury. Wherever you see this spirit of Babylon goes, we're talking about serious, gaudy luxury of the religion. It becomes so sensual. Everything is visual, beautiful. That's why you have stained glass windows, folks. That's why churches, I know it's getting harder and harder to convince you of this, but that's why churches have stained glass windows. The spirit of Babylon. A gaudiness, a delicacy, a luxury, art. And then, of course, the last one is the spirit of Antichrist. Not in the sense that he's opposed to Christ, but in the old Greek sense that it's a counterpart of Christ. Someone who takes the place of Christ as the Antichrist, that's the spirit of Babylon, and we'll have to leave it for there.